Good morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties and on AM 930 in Los Angeles County. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, what is it about Catholicism and sports? There's a question. Take even a cursory look around at high school athletics, college athletics, all the way up to the professional ranks in almost any sport you can name, and you'll find Catholic athletes excelling and, in many conspicuous cases, representing themselves, their sports, and their faith with a great deal of dignity, humility, and good sportsmanship. With us this morning is a man who is dedicated to that ideal, Ray McKenna. Ray is a Washington, D.C.-based attorney and a former general counsel of the General Services Administration, and he's also a former lay baseball chaplain. How about that? But he's here today as the president and founder of a wonderful organization called Catholic Athletes for Christ. The goal of this group is, and I'm quoting now, to provide an integrated network of sports-oriented clergy and lay people to serve Catholic athletes, coaches, and staff in the practice of their faith, and to utilize the unique platform given to them to reach the world for Jesus Christ and His church. Ray, welcome, and thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Pat. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, Ray, that vision there is a laudable goal you set for the organization. I'm also guessing it's a pretty tall one. You minister to athletes from students to pros, and you travel the world doing it. Well, tell us something about how the Catholic Athletes for Christ got started and why.
My pleasure. Believe it or not, it's hard for me to believe, but we're be celebrating our 10th birthday in March of next year, 10 years.
Wow.
And we refer to ourselves on our website, which is simply CatholicAthletesForChrist.org, mm-hmm. as the name in Catholic sports ministry, and we may be the only name in Catholic sports ministry. We started because my experience, you alluded to it in the introduction, as a lay minister in baseball, an organization called Baseball Chapel.
Right.
And I've been in other organizations and work with a Fellowship of Christian Athletes and what have you, is I realized that there are well-established, well-funded evangelical Protestant sports organizations, which number in, I think, excess of 85. And there wasn't a single Catholic sports ministry, not one. And the result of that became very obvious to me over time and many of the others who've involved in the founding of Catholic Athletes for Christ, which is namely that the faith has suffered, that thousands of Catholic players have left the faith because they've been proselytized by non-Catholic sports organizations, and also that those who have remained have had their faith somewhat watered down or neutered. We have many athletes, who, like Mike Sweeney and Mike Piazza and others, who say that, you know, they had been told to go up and, you know, not to say that they were Catholic, but just to say that they were Christian.
Uh-huh.
And fortunately, that became kind of the least common denominator approach. Anyway, probably too long-winded of an answer, but that's how it started.
Well, what is it about sports particularly that lends itself so well and so easily to ministry and evangelization and camaraderie among athletes? It seems that quite a number of athletes are quite religious, and Catholic athletes tend to be not necessarily as demonstrative as some of the more fundamentalist athletes, but they do hang on to their faith quite tightly.
Great question, great insight on your part. I would say, I'll start with an anecdote to answer the question. One of our guys who's very involved with us, former NFL Super Bowl champion Matt Burke, who works with the NFL right now, shares a story that when he began in football, one of his coaches said, "Football is a game that brings you to your knees. You may as well start there." Prayer, you know, and faith, I think, is integral to sports, especially at the highest levels, if not all levels. And I think also we have, we're developing something quite excited about. I was invited this past May to Rome to speak at the Vatican Sports Conference, and I spoke on our theology of sports, which is very much an outgrowth and development of the teachings of John Paul II, St. John Paul II. And basically, it's simply this. It's recognition that faith and sports are opposite sides of the same coin. They're not opposed, certainly. Okay, so we want to refute that misunderstanding that's very widespread. They're not in opposition to each other. In fact, they are compatible. One supports the other. One promotes the other. For example, practice. To be a good athlete, everybody knows. Everybody knows you have to practice. You don't just show up at the game, but you have to put in hours and hours of hard and arduous practice. Well, the same with the faith, for example. You don't just show up on Sunday and, you know, be a good practicing Catholic. You don't show up 15 minutes late, but, you know, you work at it each and every day. You arrive to Mass early. You pray. And so it's kind of the same. I think that sports and faith are just so compatible, especially sports and Catholicism. All sports have a great ritualistic aspect that people are very familiar with. And the same is true of the faith, of course. So there's so many comparisons.
Well, there's obviously a lot of people that you've assembled that agree with you. You've put together a very impressive lineup of bishops and archbishops and cardinals who are serving on your Episcopal board. The enthusiasm to get involved must have been high among those guys.
Oh, praise the Lord. I think it's the Holy Spirit that assembled everybody, but I'm very thankful for the Holy Spirit. And as anyone who can go to our website will see that, you know, we have Cardinal Dolan, Cardinal O'Brien, Bishop Pepperocki, Bishop Gomez, and many, many others, and top-flight athletes like Coach Jack Del Rio of the Raiders, and Mike Sweeney, Mike Piazza.
Let me stop you there for just a second. I put together a kind of a short list of some of the athletes you've got on the athlete advisory board. You mentioned Mike Sweeney, the former captain of the Kansas City Royals. You got Sal Bando, the former All-Star third baseman for the Oakland A's. Lou Carnesecca, the former men's basketball coach for St. John's University. Jack Del Rio, as you mentioned, the head coach of the Oakland Raiders. David Eckstein, a lot of people will remember him around here, who helped the Angels win the World Series in 2002. Mike Piazza, of course, the former Dodger catcher. They're all enthusiastic participants and promoters of the organization and its goals, I'm guessing.
Absolutely, and in answer to the question about why or their interest, I think it's, you know, they were really looking for an organization like Catholic Athletes for Christ to participate because, as I alluded to in the opening, there's always been kind of a emphasis and influence to mute our Catholicism for those of us who are athletes, played athletes, as to say, you know, hey, we're just Christians, we're just all Christian, you know, and we, so there's a pent-up desire to go out and say, I'm proud to be a Christian, but I'm a Catholic Christian.
Yes.
My Catholicism, you know, obviously, you know, I think I've heard it said that Christian is our first name and Catholic is our last name, you know, so we want to be fully identified and correctly identified by our full name.
Well, and part of your vision statement of Catholic Athletes for Christ, and this one I want to touch on for a couple minutes, is, and this is a quote, to reverse the moral crisis in sports today. Tell us a little bit more about that. How does this moral crisis manifest itself in sports now?
Oh, in a variety of ways. I had the pleasure about a month ago to be in New Haven and have a meeting with the Supreme Knight, Mr. Carl Anderson, who's actually a wonderful gentleman, as you probably know. And he gave me one of his books, Beyond a House Divided, it's called. And I was reading it on the airplane back home, and I noticed that there was a poll that it's in the book referred to that the public perception is that of professional athletes that 12% of them are a positive influence on society, and 67 are a negative.
Really?
By the rest are kind of neither.
Yeah.
I think that one statistic points it out. I mean, sadly, sports, which at one time in this country, probably in the 1940s and 50s, was considered to be a great engine for virtue and good, has sadly become to be associated with vice. So that's what we're trying to do, is to, as my good friend Bill Thierfelder, who's on our board and the president of Belmont Abbey College in North Carolina, likes to say, we're trying to reclaim the game for God.
And the moral crisis, are we talking about something that cuts across professional sports, no matter what the game? I mean, if you're talking Major League Baseball, the first thing that comes to mind is doping. Probably the same thing for pro football. Off-the-field activities, you know, you can read about that almost every week. It is happening, of course, but this you're doing something to counteract it in a fairly visible way.
And I say it does. I mean, you know, sports is really just a microcosm of our larger society, you know, societal and cultural problems. So, I mean, you know, it's not surprising that in every sport and every level of sport, you're going to see the problems that pervade society, you know, and it's this entanglement of sports with the entertainment culture and the media, which is, you know, become one and the same that promotes that. And that's, you know, but I mean, you know, it's a problem in sports, but it's a larger problem in Hollywood and business and everywhere else.
Well, in the 30 seconds we've got left in this segment, I want to ask you about your Speakers Bureau. You've got what looks like a very healthy Speakers Bureau with both athletes and clergy. Are they kept pretty busy, and how are they received?
Well, we have over 130, but they're underemployed, so I'd like to encourage your listeners to look at our Speakers Bureau on our website and see if, you know, one or more could come and speak to their parish, men's or women's conference, or, you know, whatever type of youth gathering. Because we have some great speakers, but we would love to employ them even more fully to evangelize and share the good news through sports.
Well, we'll be back in just a minute for more with Ray McKenna and Catholic Athletes for Christ as we pay a visit with Ray to the Vatican. So please stay with us.
Faustina, messenger of divine worship, comes to the Fried Theater on the Christ Cathedral campus beginning on August the 21st. This live, multimedia drama, performed by Maria Vargo and directed by Leonardo DeFilippis, is an amazing look into the spiritual life and strength of faith of St. Faustina. For tickets and more information, visit ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. That's ChristCathedralCalifornia.org.
Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. We are visiting with Ray McKenna, the founder and president of Catholic Athletes for Christ, a unique ministry that serves Catholic athletes and coaches from students to pros. Well, let's talk about some of the activities you and the organization have been up to lately, Ray. First, you were invited by the Vatican Pontifical Council for the Laity to speak at its international seminar recently. It was titled Coaches, Educating People. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it was quite an honor, and I had an opportunity to address over 100 invited guests from perhaps, I believe it was, 8 or 9 different countries. I know there was simultaneous translation in perhaps 7 languages. I was asked to speak on the issue of the coach and the role of the coach in sports. And what I spoke about was our theology of sports and how coaching, we call it coaching with love, really is kind of a growing and sweeping phenomenon, is to basically turn things on their head, to stand them right side up, as Jesus always did, to show that it's the coach that really cares about his or her players, the coach that loves those players, that gets the best results about from those players, but also has the most lasting impact beyond the wins and losses, which are relatively transitory. Beyond the wins and losses, the people who really affect players' lives are those that care about them and really love them.
It doesn't mean you have to be a marshmallow of a coach, does it? It just means you have to communicate the fact that you are vitally interested in the lives of your players.
Well, great question. In fact, though, quite to the contrary. You don't have to be weak at all. One of the major questions we get, issues we deal with, our core virtues. In fact, one of the 7 core virtues we have on our website for organization at our high school chapters is meekness. And meekness, I believe, is the most misunderstood virtue because the world associates it with weakness, and it's the polar opposite. Jesus is the model of meekness, but he's not the model of weakness. Jesus was the strongest man who ever lived. So that's what we're trying to do, is understand you be meek is to have great power, but under control. Any fool can scream and curse and yell and punch. To have great courage and strength to control that, and love in the hard-paced, hard-hitting profession. professional, very, you know, intense, high-profile environment. But we also think that the evidence shows it's the most successful way. It seems almost contrary to human experience, but when you reflect upon it, you see that it's actually true.
Well, I'd like to kind of circle back to the Vatican for just a second. A photo in one of your most recent newsletters has you meeting the Pope. That had to be very exciting, particularly since the Pope is a sports fan.
Hard to describe what a blessing beyond belief it was just to shake his hand and look into his eyes and have him touch me and just give a blessing for my whole family. One of the moments of my life I'll never forget. It was an incredible blessing. Yes.
Wonderful. Well, we've been talking about pro athletes for a while here. I'd like to dial it down just a touch. On a smaller but also a significant scale, CAC hosted a Catholic baseball camp in Virginia in July, and you had an excellent turnout, I understand. Tell me about that.
That's right. We recently had a Catholic baseball camp over, I think, about 85 or 90 attendees. And we had Craig Stammen, who's a player for the Washington Nationals, and four former Major League Baseball players among the instructors. And very excitingly, nine of the additional baseball instructors were priests who play on a local team here in the Washington Arlington area called the DC Padres.
Wow.
We started the day off with Mass. We had some faith presentations and high-quality, highest-level baseball instruction. I think it was a huge success, and we're hoping to do many more. We work closely with Mike Sweeney, and he's had five or six Catholic baseball camps around the country, San Diego, Seattle, Chicago, and hopefully over time we'll do them in every city.
Fantastic. Well, and you're continuing to add Major League Baseball teams to what you call your Mass ministry. Tell me what that's about.
That's right. And let me ask your viewers and yourself for your prayers. We almost have all 30 Major League teams. We're at 26 now. We provide our sacramental ministry as Catholics, and we work to have a Mass and confession available during the season, every weekend, every Major League stadium. That's our goal. And we have, for example, close to home for you there in Anaheim in Orange County, a Mass for the Anaheim Angels, California Angels. Mike Socia, good friend who I just happened to see last week in Kansas City, is the kind of the impetus behind that. And Mike's been a great friend and of CAC's and mine and helped us get it started there and around the league. And it's a wonderful thing to see Catholics come together, because before we began this, basically Catholics had one option. If they weren't able to get to a Mass, as they often are not, especially on the road, is to go to Baseball Chapel, which is a non-denominational ministry that I used to be part of. It's nice, it's a Bible message from a minister, but it's not the Mass, it's not the sacrament. So we think for Catholics, you shouldn't have to choose between going to Mass and playing ball. So that's why our Mass ministry is so very essential to us.
Well, how does that work? Does a priest come down to the ballpark and hold Mass in the clubhouse, or what happens?
Well, it's always in the clubhouse. Sometimes in some places in the clubhouse, other places it's an adjacent room or press room or catch can. And each Mass in each stadium is a little bit different. The attendees, sometimes it's the tour of the team players, managers, general managers. In other places, it's open up to stadium personnel. In New York, with the Yankees and the Mets, we may have 150 attendees, most of them stadium employees like firemen, policemen, stadium vendors. It all depends. And we have, going back to our integrated network of Catholic athletes, ministers, and priests, we have about 300 volunteer Catholic priests who are involved with our organization, who stay Mass at the stadiums and otherwise involved with our high school chapters or what have you. So we like to try to have a Catholic presence everywhere there's a sports team.
Well, let me ask this. I was very curious when I was putting this together as to how this was going to shake out. You've got a core of Catholic athletes. You've got a priest coming down, and they're having Mass, let's say, in the clubhouse, and you have different personnel around. What effect does that have on the other players, on the other people around who may not be Catholic? Have you gotten any pushback on that, or is it generally well accepted?
I'd say yes and no. We've gotten some, because as I mentioned before, prior to 10 years ago when Catholic Athletes for Christ began, there was no Catholic presence. So
right.
For since 1972, there's something called Baseball Chapel, which I was part of in baseball, and it's provided a kind of a Protestant or non-denominational, as they call themselves, ministry. And then in the other sports, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes has been around since 1953, and pretty much they've had the field to themselves. So there's been a little bit of kind of a resentment, maybe, or, you know, that we're invading their territory.
Mm-hmm.
Catholic players, I think there's been a largely positive reception, and there's been some misunderstandings here and there. I mean, you know, some people don't understand why faith is important to begin with. Others don't understand why Catholicism, they view it as if we're looking for a preferential option. In other words, they'll say, well, why should Catholics be treated differently than other denominations, for example? And our response is very simple. I mean, one is, we are a sacramental religion. I guess that's one, in, you know, in 1A. So therefore, you can't be Catholic and not receive the sacrament. So I don't think non-Catholics understand that, and sadly, sometimes Catholics don't understand that.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is that there needs to be a Catholic witness to, and in a specifically Catholic way. I think the Holy Father is a great example of this. And that's something that we're trying to promote, explain Catholicism, that, you know, and also wherever we are, by the way, I want to say this and make it very clear, it's an essential point. We are never there to proselytize, okay,
right.
Because we're there to serve Catholics, basically. If somebody else wants to come up and ask about what we do, we tell them. But we don't go in their locker room or anywhere and try to convert anybody. We think that's appropriate. We want to respect the locker room, and we want to respect their faith and their religious views.
Well, in the couple of minutes we have left, I want to talk a little bit about a part of your work that I think is probably very dear to your heart. Tell us about the Catholics Chapter Program at the high school level, what it is and how does it work. Now, I have to say I was very intrigued by this description that I found on the website. It says, the Catholics curriculum derives its uniqueness by combining diverse and seemingly unrelated items, such as the musings of Yogi Berra and Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, into a compelling series of lessons. I thought, Berra and Benedict, wow.
Maybe no other sentence or anywhere that has the two of them. we're quite excited about the Catholics Chapter. It's the number one initiative of, I think you alluded to, our 24 or 28 bishops involved in our advisory board. It's their number one emphasis is to really invigorate Catholicism among high school athletes. And we think that's so very important because, you know, we find it that that's where, you know, the faith very much gets diluted, especially in sports. And it's because there hasn't been a presence, we think, an explicit Catholic sports presence, that so many Catholics have been easy prey when they've gone on to college or professional ranks to leave the faith and go to a so-called non-denominational ministry or faith.
Right, right. Let's tell our listeners how they can become involved or how they can support Catholic Athletes for Christ. Where can they go? Where can they call?
Go to our website. We could always use financial support if they're able to do that. It's a tax-deductible way through the website to do that or to mail us a check. But just pray for us. And also, if they want to volunteer, there's ways they can volunteer and become involved or start a chapter at their high school or even, you know, junior high school, which we're just beginning, a junior high school chapter program.
Wonderful. Well, Ray McKenna, many thanks for taking time out of what is undoubtedly a very busy schedule to be with us today. We'll be following your ministry and rooting for you always.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. God bless you and everything you're doing at Immaculate Heart Radio and on your show. We'll be praying for you.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll be visiting with some folks from Mission Basilica San Juan Capistrano to learn about their big annual gala and to hear about how preparations are ramping up for the canonization next month of Blessed Junipero Serra. Don't go away.
Faustina, messenger of divine worship, comes to the Fried Theater on the Christ Cathedral campus beginning on August the 21st. This live, multimedia drama, performed by Maria Vargo and directed by Leonardo DeFilippis, is an amazing look into the spiritual life and strength of faith of St. Faustina. For tickets and more information, visit ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. That's ChristCathedralCalifornia.org.
Well, as the summer of 2015 wears on, we Southern Californians are being reminded more and more that our state has been in a severe drought for many months now, and things don't seem to be getting any better or any wetter, at least in the short run. For many of us in the Diocese of Orange, Pope Francis's recent encyclical on the environment hit home with more force than usual, particularly when he addressed the issue of conservation of natural resources. In our case, particularly now, that means being more mindful than ever of how we use and sometimes waste water. Following the lead of Pope Francis, as well as exercising common sense, it's up to us to make sure that we're being good stewards of the environment. Here to give us some ideas on how best to do that is Mike Marcus. He is the general manager of the Orange County Water District. Mike, thanks very much for taking time out of your day to be with us on Orange County Catholic Radio.
Oh, you're very welcome, Patrick.
Well, we've talked about being stewards of the environment, and that's just what the Orange County Water District does. You're not a municipal water agency in the sense that you don't provide water directly to people's houses, but the job you do is every bit as vital. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it is. What we do here at the Orange County Water District is we manage a very large groundwater basin that actually provides North and Central Orange County about 70% of its potable water supply. So that's something that I think most people don't realize, Patrick, is a very high percentage of our water comes out of this groundwater basin. Now, why is that important to us? Well, mainly groundwater costs about a third of what imported water costs us.
Right.
So imported water is water that's provided by the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. It's basically water from the Colorado River in Northern California,
right,
of which most of the region is dependent on. However, we're not. So it's important for us here in Orange County, in the Orange County Water District, to be able to resupply that basin with water so that we're able to continue to use this precious natural resource that God has blessed us with. And we do that in a number of ways. We get flows down the Santa Ana River. If you notice up in particularly the Anaheim and Yorba Linda area, there's always water flowing in the Santa Ana River, and that comes downstream. We capture it in our recharge basins up in the Anaheim area, and then it slowly filters into the groundwater basin. However, we can't rely on that. Those flows have been decreasing. And so what the district has done, what our board of directors has done, is they have invested significantly in recycled water. Back in the mid-90s, we started doing some pilot testing on different technologies that would treat wastewater that goes to the Orange County Sanitation District that's fully treated, and then that's the waste that comes from each of the households, from inside the house, toilets, showers, sinks, dishwashers, washing machines. It goes to the Sanitation District. They treat it through a two-step process whereby it's safe enough to be discharged to the ocean. But what we do, instead of wasting it to the ocean. So we look at wastewater not as a waste but as a resource. We take that water, we run it through an advanced purification process consisting of microfiltration, reverse osmosis, UV light with hydrogen peroxide. By the time that wastewater goes through that advanced purification process, it's of distilled drinking water quality. We then take that water, we put it back into the groundwater basin as a source of supply. And the facility we're operating here produces 100 million gallons per day of recycled water.
It's a really huge facility, as I understand.
Well, it's the largest of its kind in the world.
Yes.
And that 100 million gallons actually provides enough water for about 850,000 people a year.
Fantastic. Well, we're thwarting William Mulholland here. I mean, this is all of our own stuff.
Well, it is, and the beauty of it is it gives us water supply reliability, Patrick. In other words, we don't have to rely on these outside sources of water that are subject to restrictions, environmental restrictions in the case of the water that we get from Northern California. It's also restricted by hydrology, just the weather patterns.
Mm-hmm.
If it's dry, there's cutbacks on the amount of water that's shipped from Northern California to Southern California. So we're actually, not 9 years into a 10-year drought is the way we put it. In the last 10 years, we've only had 1 year of above-average rainfall.
Wow.
So we have to get smarter. We have to look at ways. Certainly, we should conserve water first and foremost. And I think the governor's emergency drought actions is having us do that. We're starting to think more about water and turning that tap off and not watering our lawns as much. And we need to develop that what I would refer to as water ethic. And then what we need to do is recycle as much as we can. We're doing a great job of that here in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we still need to round out our water portfolio, there's always the ocean. There's always seawater desalination as a part of that portfolio.
Well, it's easy to forget, isn't it, that Southern California is essentially a desert that's been extensively irrigated. It's an arid coastal region, right?
We live in a desert. I mean, I've lived here my entire life. We take it for granted. The other thing, I always say we as a water industry have done a very poor job of education. People turn on their faucets in the morning, anytime during the day. Water always comes out. I mean, we take it for granted, and yet most people don't understand the infrastructure that it's taken to bring that water to their households.
Yeah, it is complex, and it's a very long-standing, and it's been very, very much a part of Southern California in the last century. It's something that is a giant right before our eyes that we don't think too much about.
No, it is. We take it for granted, and yet water drives the economy. Certainly 60 years ago, probably about 90%, 95% of Orange County was agriculture, and now only about 5% is. So things have switched, but it's always driven the economy, and it's driven our lifestyle and our well-being, and it's something that is essential to life.
Well, let's talk about a few practical tips here. You hear a lot about some people changing their lawns to rock gardens, making fairly drastic changes in their water use habits, but there are some more common, maybe smaller gestures that also can be very effective in conserving water, right?
Well, there are. I mean, little things, you're right, like when you're brushing your teeth, turning the water off, off and on.
Simple as that.
Or when I'm shaving in the morning, I don't wait for the hot water to come up. I, just splash some water on my face, turn it off, shave, taking shorter showers. All these little incremental things we can do add up to a lot. I mean, when you're talking about 3 million people in Orange County, if we each were able to save a couple gallons a day, you can do the math. I mean, we can save tremendous amounts of water just through little gestures.
You're washing your car out of a bucket rather than just dousing it constantly with the hose, something like that.
Absolutely. Or just let it get dirty.
Yeah. That'll be the new normal.
It will.
So, speaking of which, there are people who are concerned out there that these current drought conditions, now you've mentioned that it's, of long standing, but that the drought is kind of the new normal, that we're looking at a very dry future here in Southern California. Do you think they're worrying needlessly? Because in the past, every drought has always ended.
It has, and those of us that have lived here for quite some time, we should be used to these. I mean, it is somewhat, droughts are cyclical. I think what's a little bit disturbing about the most current drought that we're in is a couple years during the last 10 we've had historic low rainfall in a couple of those years.
Yeah.
And so, how does that enter into the equation? I'm a believer that it is and will continue to be cyclical. We will get rain. We may not get rain as often as we do. So we have to be smarter about how we capture that rain when it does rain. Stormwater capture. Another thing our district does is we have an agreement with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to operate Prado Dam out in Corona.
Yeah.
And to store stormwater when it rains, to store water behind the dam and then slowly release it so that we can capture it downstream. I mean, the last thing we want to see is water racing underneath the 405 freeway, because that means it's going to the ocean and we haven't captured it up in our recharge areas up in Anaheim.
Well, what sort of weather do you think it's going to take in the short run to end the drought? People are talking about El Nino. Do you think that'll do it?
Well, it would take several El Ninos to get us where we need to be. And, I mean, even back the last time we had back-to-back years about 8 years ago where we had some adequate rainfall, that helped things. But it'll take several years of above-average rainfall to get us in a position where, you know, we have adequate water and storage to get us through the next drought.
Well, let's look down, hopefully, down the line a little bit to the next time when we are not in a drought situation. But even in times when we have plenty of water, it really is always good to keep conservation in mind, is it not?
You're absolutely right, Patrick. And that's why I'm really hoping that, you know, in the last several months, people have done a great job about reducing the amount of water that they're using. And what needs to happen is we need to develop that water ethic. We need to continue that water ethic, even when water seems to be abundant. Because there again, when water comes, we need to store it in groundwater basins, in reservoirs, so that when it is dry, we do have an adequate supply of water. So, yeah, we have to reduce our consumption, and I think we've done a pretty good job of that in Southern California. Projections are that water demands will remain fairly flat, even with additional population, and that's because we are doing a better job of conserving water. But we do have to be ever mindful, even when water is plentiful, that we need to save water.
Well, Mike Marcus, thank you for being with us today and for giving us a very clear picture of our current dry conditions and what we can do about it, and what we might expect in the future. And much good luck to you in your wonderful work with the Orange County Water District.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It was my privilege.
Next, we'll visit with our old friend, Monsignor Art Holguin, who is going to tell us a little bit about what to expect in the coming Holy Year as proclaimed by Pope Francis. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. As many of you know, it's getting to be a particularly exciting time if you happen to be a parishioner at Mission Basilica San Juan Capistrano for a couple of big reasons. First, the founder of the mission, Blessed Junipero Serra, is about to be canonized a saint next month in Washington, D.C. by Pope Francis. And partially in celebration and anticipation of that historic event, the mission will be holding its annual benefit gala on September 18th on the grounds of the mission. Here to tell us all about the goings-on are Mission San Juan Capistrano Executive Director Michelle Lawrence Adams and Monsignor Michael McKiernan, who is the rector of the mission. Welcome to you both, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ian. We're very excited to be with you on the radio.
Well, first of all, for all the people out there who anticipate this big gala every year, and Michelle, this is probably for you, it's a big favorite and a very large fundraiser for Mission Preservation. In this particularly significant year, what are people going to be seeing at this gala?
Well, we like to say that we're a friendraiser rather than a fundraiser because our event doesn't have the typical auctions and hold the panel part. What we really put on is a well-executed experience in hospitality and elegance. We partner with the Ritz-Carlton Laguna Niguel, and the Mission Preservation Foundation community leaders have worked hard to deliver an unparalleled experience that begins in what is really a monument to the past, the Great Stone Church ruins, where it was built by the Native Americans under a Padre's direction and stands today as a testament to time. So in those ruins, our once-a-year concert will be happening. We only do it one time a year, and the rest of the year, they're fairly solemn and serious space. So out of respect, we only do it to raise money for preservation so that we can keep those stories alive. And we're thrilled because this year, the concert in the ruins of the Great Stone Church features That's Life, which is a tribute to our Frank Sinatra on his 100th birthday. And the group that will be performing is well-received and well-known, John Boswell, Scott Coulter, and Lee Lessig. Following that, the historic bells will go off in splendor, pealing in celebration in honor of Blessed Father Sarah, soon to be Saint Sarah. And we'll have a candlelight dinner to follow in our partnership with the Ritz-Carlton with a four-plated, four-course meal that is unparalleled elegance. And I have to say, we're all sold out, and so we have a wait list now. 500 people will be seating for dinner and joining us for the concert.
My gosh, 500 in the Old Stone Church. That's going to fill the place up.
Yeah, it's a really good attendance. We're excited about it because many of these people have been a part of our tradition the last decade of fundraising in a way that's unique and special. And for us, it's about bringing the history to life. History should resonate and should peal in celebration and toll in mourning when those times come. This year is really marked by being the year of the canonization of Father Sarah. And Blessed Sarah will, just the week after, become a saint, which is a huge experience for us as a landmark. And we will be having a series of events to honor and celebrate that as well.
Well, the proceeds from the gala are going to a very specific and important project, I understand, within the mission. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, yes, all of our fundraising, when you give a gift to the Historic Mission, 100% of it goes to its intended purpose. We don't capitalize gifts, and we receive no church or state funding. So we rely upon gate admission and fundraising in order to help us achieve our preservation, inspiration, and education goals. We have a long list of preservation to-dos. For instance, repairing the walkways of the mission, conserving historic paintings that we have in our collection of over 4,000 items, to make sure that we do an assessment and a conditions assessment and carry out the needed repairs on the bell wall or the west wing. So what we see this year's completion is the total preservation of the historic sala and the central courtyard. And then we'll be outlining a whole series of projects for the future. But the guests will take great pride in knowing that 100% of the gift that they give will go toward the purpose of not only conserving a historic landmark architecturally, but making sure the religious and historic significance remain primary goals of all of our efforts.
Well, about how much money is raised every year by the gala? It's pretty substantial, I understand.
Well, I just remember the first year we ever had this fundraiser and we threw a concert in the ruins. We were happy we made $60,000 and pat ourselves on the back that we could actually repair some steps. Today, the gross proceeds will be about $500,000, and after all the expenses are paid, we hope to have about $300,000 to put directly into the physical caretaking and stewardship of a landmark that is now a place that a saint once walked. So we see the identity change of the mission, not only a California landmark, but it is a Catholic landmark, and that is very significant in the coming years ahead, as we believe people will pilgrimage to this site and want to walk the very ground that soon-to-be St. Sarah once walked.
Well, I want to get into that a little bit with Monsignor McKiernan here. Monsignor, things have to be getting fairly exciting around the mission grounds on a pretty much a daily basis these days in anticipation of the canonization. Is that right?
They truly are. People are constantly talking about the wonder of being in a place that, you know, we celebrate Mass every morning at 7 o'clock in the Sarah Chapel, Monday through Friday. And it's the only place that Sarah actually celebrated Mass himself. And it's the only place left. And so it's a wonderful gift to the people of the parish to actually celebrate in a place where Sarah celebrated himself. It's a phenomenal experience every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning to be in a place. And then the excitement of the parishioners just continues to grow. We're going to be doing some simulcast of the canonization in three different places on the campus. I'm hoping to be at canonization myself in Washington. And then we're going to have some parishioners here from the parish who actually will go. And so it's a really exciting event. And then we've got all kinds of special things planned for the celebration here at the Historic Mission to commemorate each of the days after and before the actual canonization.
I imagine that I know you have regular people that would show up just about every day for Mass in the Sarah Chapel over the course of time. But I imagine now you're getting even more people in there just, again, in anticipation of the canonization. Is that right?
We definitely are. And one of the things that I'm amazed by is that we often have standing room only at morning Mass.
Really?
At 7 o'clock. It's just wonderful. It's great to have a full church and we sing an entrance hymn, and every I tease them, and every day that they sing stronger and stronger.
And the great thing about that, now that's before we even open ourselves to the public. So Monsignor McKiernan celebrates the Mass there in tradition that's happened for over two centuries. But after, when we open up to the public as a landmark, we still have people that want to know when is the Mass or how can they feel the essence of Father Sarah. So they will go and sit in the church, even without Mass services, and also take part in the St. Peregrine Side Shrine Chapel, because he's also the patron saint of cancer sufferers. So Sarah's Chapel is well-loved and well-appreciated, not only by Catholic community, but by the world at large that recognizes Sarah's unique role as a California framer and his historic impact on California, and as well as the inspiration that comes from such a place that still has withstood the test of time. Monsignor and I are very much excited to be a part of this special chapter, but we also realize it's a game change, because we noticed when the Holy Father announced the canonization was going to happen this fall, back in January of this year, our attendance started to spike. And that lasted for about 3 months, where we really saw a difference. And so he and I, we were trying to figure out, what does this mean for a California landmark that we pride on being an old mission in a special place and keeping those elements quaint, and at the same time balancing the delivery of an access and sustainability. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, but the good news is we both are up for it. We're excited about it.
Well, I imagine that the coming canonization tends to make the history of the mission a lot more real and a lot more vivid to a lot of people. And I'm thinking particularly, is it fourth grade students that do California history and that come down to the mission a lot? I imagine those students are just getting a special extra dose of history as a result.
Well, we'll see what the teachers think from the public schools and the private school variety that we get. I think that week will be especially meaningful for them. I know when the Holy Father was installed as Pope and we were able to ring the bells in his honor the day of his investiture or installation, the public just clamored. They had, even if they weren't Catholic, they were thrilled and they stopped and they said prayers. So I think this is going to be very special for anybody who is here during that week, but in the years to come. We see over 75,000 fourth graders from all walks of life. We have an active scholarship program to deliver education programs to our most needy children and students in California. And the students are definitely part of our inspiration to deliver such a meaningful site and engaging experience. So I have a feeling we'll be the memory place for a lot of fourth graders this year, and I'm excited about that.
Even as you may know, there are, of course, 21 California missions, 9 of which were founded by Sarah himself. We are number 7 of those 9. And one of the wonderful traditions we have here at Mission San Juan Capistrano is every morning at 9 o'clock, one of our bells rings 7 times to recognize the fact that we are number 7 of those 9 missions that were actually founded by Sarah. It's an amazing place, and it's a wonderful connection with history.
Just in about the 30 seconds we have left here, Monsignor, you're anticipating being in Washington for the canonization. What's going to be happening at the mission on the day of the canonization? Anything specific?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we'll be celebrating Masses here at the mission at 7 o'clock in the morning, as we always do, as well as 8:30 in the Basilica. We also will have the bell ringing at noon to recognize this very special day in the life of the mission, as well as I mentioned earlier, the simulcast of the canonization, of the Mass of canonization that's taking place at Catholic University of America in the sala, in the barracks, and in the school gym.
Well, Michelle Lawrence Adams and Monsignor Michael McKiernan, thanks so much for being with us today, and much good luck with the gala and all the attendant celebrations connected with the canonization of Blessed Junipero Serra.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the time to share with you.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties, and to AM 930 in Los Angeles County. I'm Patrick Mott.